This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Sharad Kutin, and welcome to the show that walks you through some fundamental concepts in the social sciences and humanities. Together with Amat Fuad Rahmat, the show tries to reveal how various thinkers have grappled with theories and frameworks that better to understand how society works. Each week, we discuss a classic text or an idea we hope will shed light on the world around you. And this week's idea is cannibalism. And the person who's going to lead us in this fascinating discussion is none other than Lau Yao Hua. You've heard him before. He's an ecologist and got his PhD in entomology from UC Davis in the United States, which means that he is well suited to talk about cannibalism. I can find the word. Okay, there it is. So, Yao Hua, I know, of course, that you, taking this from a kind of natural science perspective, why did you choose cannibalism? Why did you think that would be the most interesting topic?
Yeah, well, cannibalism is actually very close to my heart, because it is the crux of my PhD thesis. And you say I'm well suited to talk about cannibalism. Yeah, I think sometimes doing a PhD thesis makes one feel like eating something. The supervisor, maybe.
Or your fellow, PhD candidate.
PhD candidate. Or more the research assistants who are not doing their job. Why cannibalism? You started in the beginning saying that this show is all about fundamental ideas. Cannibalism in biology or zoology, it has long been regarded as an abnormal behavior. It's not a natural behavior. The animals express it only when they are stressed out in labs or in cages. And that's when people observe cannibalism among animals. So for a very long time, people regarded it as something weird and not natural. Only until the 70s and the early 80s, when a few researchers compiled like a long list of observations of animals in the wild committing cannibalism, then we begin to accept it as, oh yeah, maybe there is some functions to cannibalism. And now it is now widely accepted that cannibalism is a natural part, it's a natural part of an animal's behavior. And so is it a fundamental idea in ecology? Not necessary, but it is definitely a fundamental behavior than an animal can express.
This might be the anthropocentrist in me asking, but why do they eat their own kind? Is it only when under conditions of duress or desperation in the wild, or is there other reasons?
Well, before you answer that question, we're just kind of getting into the phenomena itself. Yeah. I just wanted to talk about or ask a question around the very notion of cannibalism, because I always imagined that cannibalism was a concept that applied only to human beings. That, you know, since, you know, as human beings, we eat everything else around us that can be eaten and some things that really shouldn't be eaten, what we've restricted ourselves from doing is eating each other. And that's where the idea of cannibalism kind of appears. Mm-hmm. The question is, why have we now, and why have scientists extended it to other creatures who don't have the same cultural, political, and social concerns as we do? I mean, what is the problem for a beetle to eat another beetle, a chimpanzee to kind of murder another chimpanzee and eat it? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, whereas for us, we know it's a problem, right?
Yeah. So you're basically asking why should we be so surprised that animals, wild animals, would kill and eat their own kind?
Yeah, surprised,
right?
Or even bothered.
Oh, okay. Well, why we should be bothered is a different question. We can touch on that later. But why we are surprised is, if you think about it, our behaviors are partially determined by our genes, right? So this comes back to that evolution and natural selection argument again. Is any behavior or any morphological trait or behavior that we observe today, you know, if it has been evolving, you know, under selection for millions of years, then it should impart some sort of benefit to the individual. Well, cannibalism is a behavior that eats your own kind, and the word is conspecific. It means that in an individual of your same species, you may share some genes, right? And so if I consume leisurely any individual of my own species, then it kind of makes no sense, because the genes for cannibalism should have been removed from the population. You can't have something eating its own kind all the time. It should have been removed long time ago. So paradoxically, we find that it's very common, and some animals actually actively do it. And so, and that became surprising for us.
Okay, yeah. Sorry. Maybe go back to your
so
question.
Why do they do it? Like, under what conditions does that happen?
Yeah. Well, to ask why would one do it, I think it's easier to ask why shouldn't one do cannibalism? Because if you think about it, there are different ways of defining cannibalism. So let's use the one where an individual deliberately kills and eats another individual of the same species, right? So this would not mean like if I sort of like breastfeeding wouldn't be considered cannibalism. So why shouldn't you do it? Like do you expect your cats to eat each other?
Well, I mean, clearly there are no legal implications, right? I mean, a cat looks at another cat. Yeah. Perhaps if they're hungry. You know, there was that horrible scene in the last James Bond movie, right? Where he talks about this experiment about these rats. And these rats eventually so hungry that they started to eat their own kind, right? So I think, well, maybe in a situation where the cats are driven to such hunger that they stop relating to each other, you know, and seek to... that's the only available food, you know. And I think there have been instances where human beings have been driven to that, you know, like a plane crash or something, and they're only survivors, and they look at the meat that's available and such.
Yeah, exactly. So cannibalism, some scientists, I remember vividly one of my supervisors saying that, you know, cannibalism to a cannibal, everything else is just food. And so, you know, if I'm sitting next to Fuad now, right? And so if I'm very hungry and there are no other food around, I would look at you, Sharad, and I'll look at Fuad and I'll say, okay, which one should I eat? I'm not even talking the human context. I'm talking about any animal's perspective, right? So, okay. Eating any one of you would allow me to extend my life, give me another shot at, you know.
But you mentioned that it's only when there's nothing else to eat, right? Is that the case?
Yeah,
usually.
Well, when I get very hungry, so under what conditions will I become hungry? When there's no food or no suitable food, or you are the most nutritious food item around. So, okay, I'll probably eat you.
I think actually I'm the most nutritious food item in this
You may
studio.
Be the bigger food item, but nutritious is a different thing.
No, meat without marbling is not tasty.
But can an animal tell the nutrition from size?
I'm not sure if they can tell the nutrition from... Well, actually, animals can choose. They can definitely choose. Even insects can choose what sorts of food items they want to eat. Huh. So they would go for... I guess if they have evolved to know what sort of foods are good for them. It's just that we can tell, you know, after you have done sports, you know what are the food items that your body demands the most, right? You're not going to go for something plain. You want something sugary. You want something sweet, right?
Or so fatty,
your body
knows, right?
The meat with marbling. Yeah, exactly. So one reason for cannibalizing your own kind is just driven by hunger, as you mentioned about the rats. But then that brings into... and then if I consume one of my own kind, I'm also reducing competition for another food, right? So you say there's a pizza here, right? And I'm very hungry. We're all hungry. Three of us are very hungry. I can take that pizza. Yeah, it's not enough for three of us. Maybe it's enough for three of us, but I'll gain more if I eat your share too. So can I eat your share? Well, I remove you from the equation first.
But if you ate Fuad first, you might not actually want to have the pizza now. You might want to keep it for later. But still, it would work, right? The logic of it would work.
Yes,
yeah. So, okay, removing competition, and then, fulfilling your desire, your need, hunger for food. Okay, what else?
Those are the main ones. Those are the main drivers.
But there's certainly drawbacks, right?
Exactly. Retaliation from either one of you. Oh, lots of cannibalism going on.
Is that kin retaliation?
What do you
mean?
So
the brother of the victim would retaliate. Does stuff like that happen?
Under normal conditions, you expect retaliation from anyone who's about to be chewed off. But the kin, the drawback that Sharad mentioned is another major consideration on why animals suppress cannibalism. I mean, if what I just say is true, then I have three dogs at home. They should be eating each other when we are not feeding them. The retaliation is one, right? Because if you're eating, if you try to attack someone of your own kind, he or she is just as well armed as you are. So size matters. Okay, so between you two, I would go for one of you.
You go for Fuad.
Or you go to the gym, Sharad.
He looks weaker.
Easier. Yeah, the well, the other drawback is if I consume someone or an individual very closely related to me, that individual, say my kin or my sibling, would share, you know, more genes with me. And so it is not evolutionarily beneficial for such a behavior to kill your own kin and then consume their own kin. So in many circumstances, animals have been shown, cannibalistic animals have been shown to actually prefer to cannibalize non-kin. So they can discern that, yeah. They can distinguish that, yeah.
Are there any outstanding or noteworthy exemptions or exceptions, rather, in the animal kingdom? Like, you know, elephants, for example, very emotionally sophisticated. Yep. They show traits of what, you know, we would call civilized life.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a very strong kind of relational culture. Mm-hmm. I mean, what are there any interesting cases that shows a different pattern or different attitude to it?
Yeah, well, although I said that cannibalism is very widespread among animals, but we don't see it happening all the time. But there are actually many animals that would suppress their own cannibalistic instincts given the conditions. For example, you mentioned very early on, Sharad, that a structured society, we condemn cannibalism, right? We know it's wrong, so we don't do it. And those are more or less like rules that we set for ourselves. And those rules sort of, perhaps you can say, ingrained in an animal. Like, I remember I was studying, I was observing sting bugs, an insect, and they are predatory insects, right? So when it's a whole cluster of eggs, and then they all hatch at the same time. So you can have, say, 20, 30 of these young insects all clustered together. And for the first 2 days, they don't move around. So they don't disperse. They stick together. And if you give them a worm during this period, they will feed on that worm all together. They'll just, you know, rush towards the worm, and then they'll suck off it and kill the worm. But if you don't give them any food at all of them starve to death. Hmm. They'll just starve to death, right? And they will not kill or eat each other. All of them. I was like, yeah, when I saw that happen, I was kind of sad, but at least I learned something. And sad because I have killed them in my belief. I did kill them because I could have just saved them by giving the worm. Mm-hmm. Now, what's surprising is once they have grown older and they began to disperse, and then they no longer live together, they will begin to kill each other. Yeah, they will then start cannibalizing and then killing each other. So the most logical reason is that they have evolved to stick together in the beginning. So in that early phase, any individual they encounter is likely to be their own kin. And so then they shouldn't cannibalize. And then after it's past that stage, then they begin to disperse. Then it is less likely that any individual they encounter is their own kin. And so then no bars. No more
limitations. Did that make you sad?
No, not really. This is really serious, but you know, I think what's very fascinating about, especially higher order primates and all that, is that because they share many of the kind of social traits that we have, one of the things they do share with us is the sense of the in-group and the out-group. I mean, and you know, and it happens with a lot of, you know, we don't like to admit this, but you know, tribal societies, small-scale societies have a lot of violence, you know, and I think Jared Diamond has, you know, noted this and all that. Yeah. But because once you're in the group, you're bound by all those rules. Mm-hmm. As soon as you're a stranger, you're really kind of floating somewhere else. And I remember we will be having that episode about Camus and the idea of the stranger, right? What I'm surprised by is because I think of rules, I think of culture. Mm-hmm. And I think of how does a stink bug have culture?
I wouldn't say it's culture. Culture is something that I guess you maintain and you teach across generation. It's something that is transmitted beyond... Not within a biological means, I guess. So in this case, it's we don't see any teaching. I've not observed them. And so it's just learning. It's natural behavior.
So just so I get this right, so in a smaller setting, the relational factor is much stronger in such a way that it would affect the gene pool for evolution if they killed each other, right? But when they got dispersed, that was no longer a factor.
Yeah, well,
because they're unlikely to encounter their own.
Yeah, yeah, the clustering behavior comes first.
Right.
And
right.
So, you know, like if you're living with your family, you're not going to harm
another
human being because it's likely your own family. But once you're out in the society, then it's a fair game for everyone.
Well, like the myth of Oedipus, you know, he didn't know that it was his father that he killed, right? Mm-hmm, but okay, we're going to come back with more on the question of cannibalism, its biological, but also perhaps social, cultural and philosophical implications. Mm-hmm. You've been listening to Lau Yao Hua, who is with BFM. He's also an ecologist and studied entomology, and his PhD was on cannibalism.
Yep.
Also, Ahmad Fuad Rahmat and myself, Sharad Kutin. You're listening to Night School on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutin, and Night School continues together with Ahmad Fuad Rahmat and Lau Yao Hua. He, of course, is with BFM at the moment. He's also an ecologist and did his PhD in entomology, which makes him very suited for this topic. Not just because he studied entomology, but because his PhD thesis was on the question of cannibalism, a concept I thought was limited to human beings, but clearly something that biologists and people working in the natural sciences also use. Cannibalism, why did you even begin to think that this was going to be an interesting and productive topic for investigation?
Yeah, in other words, why did I choose to spend 3 to 4 years of my life studying cannibalism, studying insects eating their own kind? Actually, it didn't start that way. I was just studying, observing insects in cotton, in a cotton plantation. You know, there were pests in the cotton plantation. And one of the main questions, there was this insect, we call it a big eye bug. So it is a bug with big eyes. And you can find it in your gardens here in Malaysia too. So this big eye bug, you know, is a natural predator of a pest, and they release it, lots of it, and you find large numbers of this predator in the cotton, but the numbers don't seem to increase. You know, you expect that when there's lots of food in the field, the predator number should increase too. And there were more and more pests, but the predator numbers did not increase. So I came into the scene. My supervisor, Jay Rosenheim, gave me this question. Here, go check it out. Why? And we had so many ideas, hypotheses. One of it is cannibalism, because if the population is cannibalistic, then you expect that the population can't grow too much because, you know, you start eating your own kind, so you can't grow too much. And after, you know, the first year of some very large scale, large cages experiment, the results show that cannibalism is a very, very likely explanation. Yeah.
But in that case, it's a bit different than what you described before, because the pests were in the field.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So they had food. They had ample food, presumably.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But they still nonetheless resorted to cannibalism. Mm-hmm,
it's the pizza story, remember? They were reducing competition.
So they were kind of, quote-unquote, naturally competitive in that way. Like, what did your study find? What did your study conclude?
Yeah, so good question, Fuad. You make a very good ecologist.
Wow. Thanks.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm stretching my imagination here. It's quite a different world from what I'm used to, but thank you.
Exactly. So if there was so much food in the field, why did they resort to cannibalism? But first, we have to determine that cannibalism was happening. So, and as an entomologist, as someone who really loves insects, one of the great things about doing a PhD in entomology is that you spend so much time observing insects. And I remember just sitting in the lab, you know, I was going to do something, and I stopped, look at my insects, and then the last thing I know, 2 hours have passed, and I'm still looking at the insects. And no, that's really true.
People do that with their iPad. I can't imagine insects being fascinating.
Mini zoos in the lab. Miss that. We don't have that in BFM. Wow. But yeah, so... what I observed was that this big eye bug, the females, right, when they were alone with their eggs, they don't cannibalize their own eggs. They don't cannibalize the eggs of themselves or any other females. But when you put several females together in the same container, then they go wild. They went wild eating the eggs, regardless of whether the eggs were their own or eggs of another female. So I knew that they cannibalize. But there was a trigger, you know, they don't always cannibalize. So when they're alone with just the eggs, they don't do it. But when there are other females in the vicinity, they become highly cannibalistic. So is it for food or is it something else? Yeah, so that was part of my research too.
So what did you find?
I found out that it's going to be a bit more complicated because later we have to use like, we use a combination of like virgin females, you know, females that have not mated. So any eggs that they come across, they know it's not their own. And then we use females that have mated. And I have already established that the females cannot distinguish between their eggs and other females' eggs, right? So if you're a virgin female, any eggs that you come across is definitely not your own. So you should cannibalize any egg that you see, right? Giving everything else being constant. Whereas if you are a female that has laid eggs, then you need to consider whether those eggs are yours or not. So we did a few experiments and we showed that indeed that's the case. So the most logical explanation for the female's behavior is that they decide to cannibalize or not depending on how likely that egg is theirs. Because they don't have any other means of distinguishing their eggs. You know, there's no chemical cues or visual cues. So I like to put it this way. If I'm the only female in a large hall and I see three babies, likely they are mine. But suddenly there are 10 other ladies in this room. Each of these babies, you know, the probability of them being my own has decreased by that much. So everything else being constant, if I'm not going to eat the baby, somebody else is going to eat the baby. And I'm hungry. I may or may not be hungry, but in any case, it's a food waiting to be eaten. Mm. And so I do it.
Okay,
getting a bit morbid here. But,
No, I think it's fascinating. Okay, so because we do know of other animals which eat their own, right?
Yeah.
Or there are instances where they will end up eating their own. Here, the purpose is merely food. It's not the competition issue. It's the, I'm hungry, this could be eaten by somebody else, I might as well eat it. Is that the logic of the individual bug in approaching eggs? Because
it could be. I haven't really got to that stage yet. What I explained just now was what triggers them to eat or not to eat. So, but what benefits they actually got from eating it, it's another question. Whether eating the eggs are definitely more nutritional, it's a different question.
You know, what's interesting about that when you said it was morbid, I just thought myself, well, I think most of us don't consider this phenomenon when it occurs with bugs to be mm-hmm. morbid. You know, I mean, if you think of human beings, that is the final frontier. I mean, I'm thinking of Mo Yan's novel, you know, The Republic of Wine, which begins with the premise that there's a rumor that boy children are being eaten in some province in China. And it's not a province marked by poverty. In fact, it's just the opposite. It's a province that's extraordinarily rich. Mm-hmm. And it's just like the final frontier. What is forbidden? What mm-hmm. would be mm. most transgressive and the height of some sort of strange fetish for ourselves, right? So, yeah, and so the fantasy.
Because I think your relationship with it is different, though. Because in observing them for hours a day, you kind of bond with them in a way.
Did you bond with your stink bugs or the big-eyed bugs?
I feel for them as I would feel for any other insects. I don't. You can't identify each of them individually. In any case, they only live for not more than a month, as adults anyway. So I like them. I feel sad if I were the one to have to kill them. But if they eat each other, I actually find that very fascinating. Yeah.
Okay, coming back to, so all the permutations we want to work around mm-hmm. cannibalism, because mm-hmm. we started out with the idea that you needed to be explained what would be the benefit, right? So evolution, and we've gone through several of these shows mm-hmm. with you mm-hmm. now, mm-hmm. and I'm starting to understand that what animals work through, or what works through them rather, is the idea of kind of extending their gene pool, or, you know, communicating their genes across generations. Mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. there must be a kind of genetic benefit from this, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, in that kind of practice of the cotton bugs, mm. Was there any benefit to the community or the individual by eating the eggs?
You mean to the individual big-eyed bugs?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I can't say for sure. I can't say for sure for the big eye bugs. We logically think that eggs make a very nutritious package, because the egg is supposed to, the female, the mother would have imbued the egg with lots of nutrition to for the young to survive, right? So you expect the eggs to be a nutritious food item. But I haven't actually investigated if the individual gains a lot more nutritionally from eating the egg compared to eating another prey item.
You know, yeah. The thing is, do these bugs protect their eggs? I mean, you know, because...
Yeah, no, not at all. Not as far as I
can
tell.
Oh, they don't.
Yeah.
So they lay their eggs and then they abandon...
Yeah. It's very critical here that they actually move around, that the adults move around. Because if they stay in the same place, then it's a completely different story. Then we go back to that structured community where, you know, you don't... If you stay in the same place, then very likely the ones that you hang around with are your own kind. Then you become, you know, you're not as aggressive. Yeah.
How significant did these cannibalistic occurrences affect their population?
Yeah, very, very. It can throw... It prevents the population from increasing rapidly, that's for sure. And in many cases, cannibalism can stabilize a population. So cannibalism can prevent a population from exploding, in other sense. But it can also help a population survive through environments or periods of time when resources are scarce, right? If three of us, we don't cannibalize at all, and there's no food in this room for a week, none of us are going to survive, right? But if any one of us cannibalizes, then at least one or two of us will survive. Particularly depending on who.
Okay, is it possible that cannibalism of this sort with these particular bugs could lead to extinction? Is it possible that they would start to eat all the eggs available and then none would be left for the next generation?
I think unlikely because, unless it's a male that eats all of it. Because if it's a female that eats it, she gains the nutrition that will give her more resources to, you know, reproduce more. So, yeah.
The males don't cannibalize?
They do. But you're asking about extinction, right? Whether the population will go boom. Well, because males cannot reproduce, they cannot lay eggs. So if that male consumes every other individual in the population, then that's the end of it. But if a female does it and only one female is left, well, she can still reproduce. She'll have mated before, assuming that, and then she'll have enough sperm to produce more eggs. So yeah.
In the course of your studies, did you find any comparable cases to the big-eyed bugs? Where cannibalism happens more often than people would think?
I think for me, personal experience, my first encounter with cannibalism was in an insect that eats leaves. So you expect that herbivorous, animals that eat leaves and that doesn't consume meat would not be cannibalistic. But I was taking care of caterpillars. And lo and behold, caterpillars are vicious eating machines. They eat anything that come their way, including their own kind, when they get hungry. Yeah, they'll eat their own kind. So it was then that I realized that, wow, if caterpillars, you know, such cute-looking fellows, if they could just chew on their own kind, then it dawned on to me that, probably every animal, if they have the ability to do so, they would cannibalize, given the right conditions.
That's true for human beings as well, I guess.
We have our cultural norms and stuff. But if you're talking whether we are capable of doing it, I think we are well armed to do it. Yeah.
But just to have a clear picture of the caterpillars you're describing, these are caterpillars even when leaves are abundant? Or is it only cases?
When it gets crowded. Yeah, there are many situations where crowding prompts cannibalism. One of the more famous ones would be locust. Those locusts that devastates our rice fields. Yeah, they're just normal grasshoppers to start with. And then the conditions are bad, then they crowd together, they form large swarms, then they switch their behavior, switch their morphology to become cannibals. And it's very interesting though.
Very fascinating.
That's opened up a whole new field. So they actually naturally, their default is not to be cannibalistic.
Yeah, right.
But because of those conditions, when you say change their morphology, what are you talking about? Like they grow little horns and what do they get evil looking or what?
Well, they definitely get more evil looking. If you look at them, they change their morph. Yeah, morphologically, they change. They put on, they develop bright colors, warning colors. Red, black, orange, so from the original dull green, yellow, right? They become, one look at that locust, that guy means business. And they become deprived of protein because there's so much are so many locals around. They don't get the protein they need. And this is all, these are all studies done in Australia. And so then they found out that the drive, you know, we know that locusts, they form swarms and then they fly large across large areas and they, and sort of like they march across large areas. Why do they do that? One of the hypotheses is now quite well confirmed, is that they do it because you have to. If you're in there, if you don't move forward, the guy behind you and around you starts chewing on you. Because everyone is deprived of protein. So everyone just keeps on moving and moving and moving and moving. Yeah. Oh. So it changed. And locusts are not the only one. There are examples of toads that do it too. So, you know, we know tadpoles. The example I can think of is the tiger salamander. So they are usually, you know, nice behaving salamanders, the young, the larva. But when it becomes crowded, then some individuals will change their morph. They develop sharper, bigger teeth, bigger mouths, and then their bones on their jaws are changed so that they can, it helps them eat and ingest their own kind.
What would be the time span of that morphology?
It's within, it's in that individual itself. It's not across generation. That individual, because they are growing, so this is what we call plasticity, developmental plasticity.
Okay, do all animals have the same plasticity? I mean, do human beings have that plasticity?
No, I don't think we have that plasticity. I don't think this has been investigated at all.
Because one can imagine, right? I mean, in situations when human beings are, in fact, crowded, we get increasingly crowded in cities. I'm sure it changes social behavior.
Yeah.
You know, it hasn't led to changes in our sort of jaws or whatever. I mean, in our morphology, but it's certainly...
temperament, mood, yeah.
Absolutely, right? Our chemical composition, our brain chemical composition, those things might be affected by crowding and stuff like that.
Yeah, behavioral-wise, you expect... You know, it's easier to change in behavior, but to change morphologically, that really... requires, like, you need to have the genetic template for that change to happen. Behavior is a bit more complex and many things affect it. But for you to change morphologically to better cannibalize.
But okay, so Fuad, you had a contribution from Freud on the question of cannibalism, didn't you?
Just a very small one. Cannibalism is one of the basic animal instincts that humans suppress in their march towards civilization. The other two being incest and homicide.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, you know, clearly on the homicide issue, we're not suppressing it well enough.
Although we do try by building institutions, creating laws, norms, and so forth.
Right.
But of course, not too much success, given where things are.
Well, that just pushes the direct experience of murder far away. So basically, institutions kill or drones kill.
Yeah, repression isn't killing. Though, so he says that deep down, these instincts manifest in different ways, you know, into slips and jokes and dreams and stuff like that. So it doesn't quite disappear; it's just sidelined significantly.
So homicide, incest, and cannibalism. Yeah. It's interesting, you know, that cannibalism would be something that he would identify as being there, because I guess
One example is this is symbolic now. The residue of these instincts happen in our culture. Mm-hmm. They manifest in symbols. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, he used the example of communion.
Yes. Okay. The Christian religious ceremony, the eating of the Eucharist. Okay. Yeah, because the Christian story does, so the idea is that you're eating your God, right? You're partaking in his body
and
blood.
And if you look at
the
rhetoric, God died for our sins. There's an interesting relational story there between the meat that we're going to consume and our role in the passing. Yep.
Right. So, of course, because I'm thinking of, European society, I was thinking perhaps Freud had access to what would have been then a fairly robust or anthropological enterprise in the colonies, where they were encountering small-scale societies where some ritual cannibalistic acts were taking place. And I think, in fact, that anthropologists have discussed and hypothesized about cannibalism and human populations, talking about protein and such.
You know, when I was doing my research on cannibalism, I also picked up on reading about cannibalism among humans. I don't recall the title of the book, but I read now. But I think... if I remember correctly, this consumption, that eating something is a very innate or very deep, instinct of humans. And eating together and to also to partake in ritualistic cannibalism, because that person that I'm eating now, I'm a dead person that I'm eating now, was once part of my family. And so we don't let him go, you know, we sort of bring him back into ourselves. So it's not a despicable act in that sense. It's a very, I think it's a lot of respect, I guess.
Right. I think there's cannibalism that comes when we think of, say, headhunting, mm-hmm. which is about the people from other groups, right?
Yeah,
the strangers and mm-hmm, such. Mm-hmm. But there's also, and you're right, the eating of, I think there was one particular community where the brain, a bit of the brain of the deceased from the family was eaten, mm-hmm. but it led to a disease. This.
Yeah, you're talking about the Foray people in Papua New Guinea, and the disease you're talking about is the Kuru disease. Yeah, it's a prion disease, which means that it's caused by a protein that malformed. And so the disease is actually spread by the protein itself. It's not even a biological entity. It's not like something, it's not like a microbe or a virus. It's a protein that mutated and then malformed. And it can incubate in your body for years, up to 40 years before the effects are manifested. And indeed, so the Foray people... Well, Australian government has banned cannibalism since the 60s, but the Foray people before it, they were doing it. And when one among their community has passed on, they will dissect and eat that person. And the women and children, if I remember correctly, they would consume more of the brains. And it's in the brain that much of the prion, the infective protein is found. And so the women and children were particularly inflicted with the disease.
So cannibalism lives on in animal populations. It's deeply repressed in the human populations. Thank goodness for that. Let's go out for a pizza, boys.
Okay.
What would you recommend we read, Yahua?
Yeah, so there are many good books out there on cannibalism among humans, but I'm going to recommend an article about cannibalism among animals, and you can look it up. It's called Kinship and Cannibalism by David Fenwick, and it's found in the journal Bioscience. You should be able to get it free.
When was that?
Sometime in the late 90s.
You've been listening to Lau Yahua. He's, of course, with BFM. He's also an ecologist and his PhD in entomology. And Fuad, you're here. Are you going to contribute to some discussion on our Facebook page?
Yeah, I'll try to post the link to the... like that claim of fraud that we discussed, and people can look up further if they like.
Right. So that's BFM Night School on Facebook. And you can also write to us at bfmnightschool@gmail.com. Yep. Or tweet Yahua. I know you have a Twitter account. What's your handle?
Just my name, Yahua Lau.
Okay, that's L-A-W.
I spell it the other way around.
Oh, yeah. You do the American thing. Yeah. Okay, so that's Y-A-O. H-U-A-L-A-W.
Exactly.
And I'm at Sharad Kutin, spelt at Sharad Kutin. SHARAADKUTTAN. Okay, thank you so much for this episode. You've been listening to Night School. I'm Sharad Kutin, BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.